This podcast is made possible by the patrons at patreon.com. To support the show, visit patreon.com/KeithBurgun. Hello, and welcome to episode 37 of the Clockwork Game Design Podcast. I'm your host, Keith Burgun. I have a very special podcast for you today. I have a guest of high game design honors. It is Raph Koster, who you may know, you probably know if you listen to this podcast, as the author of A Theory of Fun for Game Design. And also, he was a designer on Ultima Online, Star Wars Galaxies, and a ton of other stuff. I'm going to put the link to his page in on the show notes. Definitely check it out. If you don't already know about his site, it's raphkoster.com. He's a fan of my website naming convention. This was a really good conversation. It went on long, about 90 minutes, actually. So not a lot of preamble. Let's just get right into the conversation. And I hope you enjoy this conversation with Raph Koster. So first of all, how are you?
I'm doing all right. Doing okay. Been working on my arcade cabinet a lot lately.
What is that?
I've got an emulation cabinet, so it's just one of those off-the-shelf kit-type ones with an X-Arcade controller in it, you know.
Sure.
But I have been hacking and modding it, actually. I've been drilling holes, adding controls, spinners, analog joysticks, LED buttons that light up based on the correct game. I have a robotic monitor mount so that the monitor is rotated automatically to horizontal or vertical depending on the original landscape or portrait mode of the original game or console. So like the Vectrex emulation rotates to vertical, Joust is horizontal, and you know, Raiden is vertical, whatever.
Right, sure.
And the cabinet actually emulates everything from early integrated circuit games up through most of the early 32-bit consoles. So it's a pretty giant swath of video gaming history, and I've been working on it off and on for 5 years now.
That's really great. Yeah, that's pretty cool. So that's just like a personal project just for fun, or like, do you want to, I don't know, like I can't imagine what else you could do with that, really. Have like a party or something.
Yeah, it's pretty much just for fun, but I've actually found it super useful in terms of design practice. Sure. Having that amount of video game history kind of at your fingertips is super useful, right? Mm-hmm. Not that long ago, Zoya Street from Critical Distance, I think you probably know him from Twitter, was actually in town, and he was working on a video piece about games where you are always moving forward, endless runner type ones, right?
Sure. Yep.
And I was able to go to the cabinet and pull up things like, you know, the original arcade Knight Driver, or the earliest art game I know of, which is Douglas Crockford's Hollywood Medieval on the Atari 8-bit, which even had like an interactive procedural music system, right? And pull up these examples to be able to show, hey, look, here's stuff from the 70s and 80s that fits what you're looking for.
Right.
Going through video game history chronologically is actually super illuminating, I guess, right? Because you know, looking at the games year by year to see what got invented and even how the business model changed. It was interesting, right?
Yeah.
Like the earliest arcade games were a quarter for a fixed duration of play, not lives or anything.
Interesting.
So it was like quarter a minute.
It didn't have the incentives to just have the life toll, like, you know, automatically make sure that you kill the player every X minutes sort of design that some of the later on games like Brawlers seem to have.
That's right. So instead, since it was fixed duration, it was all about maximizing your performance in the tiny window you got.
Right.
On the other hand, it also meant that the max earning potential of the machine was fixed, I guess. So
interesting.
The invention, right? The invention of quarter sucking play and eventually quarters that gave you continues is kind of like the early stages of developing whales in the video game business, I guess. So yeah, it's just useful for, I guess, design analysis, which I guess is what we're here to talk about, right?
For sure. Yeah. No, I mean, the idea, like, emulators in general are really useful, and I've always found them to be really useful, and you know, abandonware and stuff like that has always fascinated me, and I had like a good, you know, 5-10 year phase where I was just like obsessed with. Do you remember Home of the Underdogs by any chance?
Sure.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Amazing website that just like cataloged all these weird old games and like had the manuals for them, like stuff that you could not find anywhere else. And I really was obsessed with those for a while.
Yeah. And a lot of those, I grew up playing a lot of those.
Sure. Yeah.
They're not that weird to me.
Well, some of them are very obscure.
Yeah, I mean, some of them are very obscure, yes.
Yeah, I totally appreciate and respect like how much we, it's weird. I have conflicting feelings about the history of video games. Cause on the one hand, I agree there's like a lot that can be observed and stuff, but on the other hand, like, and maybe you disagree, but I sometimes feel like it's sort of shocking how little games have changed since, you know, 1980, in some ways.
No, I agree. I agree in the sense that game design growth is generally glacial. That's actually, I used that word in an interview at GDC. Mm-hmm. I said it was glacial. And I think that that's generally true. But to me, the most interesting thing about going back to, call it the pre-NES era, right, mm-hmm. is that it was kind of blue ocean virgin territory at the time. And so if anything, it was one of the golden ages of innovation, probably not equaled again until maybe the explosion of flash gaming.
Mm-hmm.
Which to me was another kind of grand renaissance of game systems and mechanics, right?
Yeah.
And it's because cost of development was cheap. Teams between 1 and 5 people could make something complete for the platform of the time.
Mm-hmm.
And the result was just exploration, right? Mm-hmm. And it's fascinating to go back to the 80s and realize, sure, we've kept elements of something like a Centipede or whatever, or elements of something like a Tempest, but wow, there's like nothing came from Joust, right?
Right.
It's really, I guess in a way, it's fascinating on both an optimistic and a depressing end.
Mm-hmm.
Because it shows there is that exploration that can be done mechanically.
But it's just not being done. Yeah.
But a lot of it isn't done.
Right, sure. Right? Yeah. Yeah, no, absolutely. And probably where I find this to be most stark is in the world of role-playing games, like RPGs, because, you know, the early Ultimas and, of course, even Ultima Online, I mean, which you famously worked on, you know, I feel like, and that was sort of rare even for that time, but the early Ultimas, to me, are a good example of, like, just such incredible ambition for what, you know, these computer worlds could be like, and you know, we don't really see as much of that since then. I feel like that was like the peak of that is in my estimation.
I think Todd Howard has probably kept the flame alive on that, right, over at Bethesda with the Elder Scrolls series. But I
really?
Agree that
I don't know if I agree.
Well, certainly relative to the rest of what's gone on in RPGs.
Yeah, maybe, yeah.
Right? I mean, back then, while we were doing Ultima Online, I guess it was the original Elder Scrolls games were coming out. The very first one was giant procedural, a completely procedural world, mm-hmm. right? Then came Daggerfall. A lot of the procedurality was toned down. But he's continued to push the boundaries some, I think, from kind of the thing that it had become, which I guess you could sum it up kind of as the children of the gold box games, the stuff done by Black Isle,
mm-hmm.
where you know, those were a peak on a narrative side, right? The writing in something like Planescape Torment was amazing. Mm-hmm. But yeah, mechanically, it wasn't trying to push boundaries in quite the same way, right?
Right.
So yeah, if I would say that probably on the system side, those guys are probably the ones carrying the torch the most. Mm-hmm. But I sure do wish I saw stuff like Dwarf Fortress level simulation in a Skyrim, right?
Right.
That's kind of where those things could come together.
Yeah, to me, it's almost like it's just kind of like a sense of and the last time I got that sense of like real ambition, maybe it was the Troika games, which were some of the Black Isle people.
Yep.
You know, mechanically Arcanum, that sort of system, or, you know, or Temple of Elemental Evil, both like to me showed like real like, wow, they're trying to really do something that kind of hasn't been done. And I don't get that feeling very often anymore. Have you tried the new Torment, by the way?
I haven't. But, you know, the thing that your comment calls to mind is a viral video that just went around a bit ago from the new Zelda, mm-hmm. which is I don't know if you've seen it. It's the moment where Link is fighting some big monster, and in attacking the monster, they're fighting in a grass field that has a couple of birds around, and the monster whacks one of the birds. And the result is that the birds all get pissed, and an entire flock of them come after the monster and kill him, right?
Uh-huh, yeah. Emergence in a Zelda game. Imagine that.
Exactly, right? And so I think, you know, I think that's what I was getting at about Glacial, right? Mm-hmm. It does happen. It's just that the diffusion of some of those concepts just takes a really long time.
Right.
And the bigger the budgets, the slower it happens because sure. it's riskier.
Yeah.
Right?
No, that makes sense. Yeah. So yeah, let's talk more about like theory and stuff. So you you wrote Theory of Fun, that to me in my world that is like the thing that, you know, makes you the great Raf Koster, is this Theory of Fun, which is my favorite book on game design. Now if I haven't told you that before,
I'm flashing back to the first time that I interacted with you online. I was not aware you had that high an opinion.
That's the thing is like I feel that in general the discipline is you know just kind of like getting started, getting warmed up, but yours has like the most of like a thesis, you know, an actual thing to say. But anyway, I want to hear it's now been 10 years since that book came out, is that right? Like, or maybe even a little more now.
Yeah, it's almost we're at 12 to 13 coming here now.
Okay.
Yeah.
So, how do you feel about it? Like looking back on it, and like, what do you think? Do you think it do you feel like it had an impact on the game design theory community, on the conversation? Do you like? How do you feel about it?
I fundamentally, and this is, I think it's one of the depressing things about working in video games as opposed to even tabletop, you know, video games, because the platforms are kind of ephemeral. I think people will remember me for that book long after they've forgotten any of my games or even are capable of playing them, especially working in MMOs where the servers go away. So in a lot of ways, it almost feels like that, you know, the writing is the legacy, right? More mm-hmm. than the games, which I often feel depressing, you know, because, you know, I'm in it for the games, not sure. not for the writing. But yeah, you know, when it came out, it was actually kind of controversial. It got mixed reviews. It was nominated back then. Game Developer Magazine did awards, right? The Frontline Awards or whatever. Mm-hmm. And it was nominated for Best Book, and it lost to like a book about game audio that nobody remembers anymore.
Interesting.
And, you know, it there was a lot of discussion around it in the academic community. And it wasn't seen as being very practical for a game designer, right? But this was in the days game programs were just getting started, right? So there wasn't, you know, there was a critical community that was in the midst of the ludology versus narratology wars. There were several academics who were kind of fighting to carve out a space for video game studies at the time, carving it out of art programs and literature programs and, you know, wherever they could, really, and creating, a, you know, digital humanities or whatever.
Right.
And so today, it's more like the opposite. Now I get a lot of comments on how it's dogma, how it's just kind of accepted and, you know, needs to be challenged more. And I think part of it is because it was legitimized so much in the process of academic programs using it and taking it up. It also had interesting influence outside of games, which, you know, as I was writing it, I was not necessarily thinking of just a game developer audience. I had hopes that it would be read outside of games by people who weren't in games at all, like people who didn't get games.
Right.
Because back then, games were in a huge struggle for legitimacy. We had not yet gotten that Supreme Court verdict about whether or not we were protected speech and artistic expression. And many developers actually did not see games as an art form. They saw games as just a product.
Right. There
were active debates about that. And this is long before the Roger Ebert thing.
Yeah.
Right. So there were plenty of developers on the oh no, we're just making toys, man.
Well, right? and a lot of people still think that, even if they won't necessarily say it as loudly, they still have that mentality. Like, that still exists, I would say.
I think it exists, but it's not, I guess it's kind of taken for granted now, I think, that games are, you know, have cultural importance, that or that games can say something, or, you know, that's like
that's
just
true.
Kind of a given these days. Even if you still think, yeah, we mostly make them for fun, I go, sure, and we write most music for fun, and we, you know, most pop songs aren't exactly saving the world, and most sitcoms don't have much to say either, and so on. I think that's just par for the course. Perfectly fine, you know, if what you want to do is be an entertainer, that is a frickin' noble goal.
Yeah.
In my opinion, entertainment is hard and worthy of respect.
Absolutely.
You know, but it does feel like a really different context. The book didn't like break out to the huge audience, but it did break out in interesting directions. It got picked up first probably by the educators. And then from there, it went sideways into what I think of as trainers. Trainers are kind of educators that work in really concrete fields, right? People who do training for business processes or how to fly planes or military training or
like a
you know,
trade.
Whatever.
Trade school.
Yeah. But I mean, and it isn't just trade school because there's plenty of these people working on white collar type things too. But yeah, all of those kinds of forms of education that aren't what we think of. They're not classroom type things, right?
Gotcha, yeah.
Those guys all picked it, resonated strongly with those guys. I got asked to keynote their annual conference, actually, which was huge, right? It's this whole parallel world that I, you know, had never paid any attention to. And then a little bit later, and this was partly through Amy Jo Kim, I think, but, you know, because she's been a booster of it ever, forever. We've been friends since we worked together on UO. She introduced it to the guys who founded, who eventually founded Bunchball, which was the first gamification company. And so I found myself in this weird position where Theory of Fun turned out to be really influential on the early gamification crowd, which I wasn't entirely, you know, approving of. Because there's a lot of, I mean, obviously games can be used to help train, and obviously there's feedback loops and all the rest. So gamification makes sense, but there's an awful lot of bad gamification that was out there.
But
so from there it started spreading to web people, and suddenly
you
I'm
mean
being
like
asked,
web design and stuff.
web design, but also Web 2.0 in general,
okay,
which started, you know, burgeoning in the period shortly after that, you know, in the aughts, I guess. So suddenly I ended up at conferences like eTech or Supernova or the O'Reilly ones. Huh. And yeah, it got picked up a lot through that and kind of taken as a more general design book, like industrial design or product design, whatever.
Well, one thing I've noticed is that, you know, games have this like rock star status in our culture. So like other disciplines, if they can bring in someone from games, you know, that's like something that they find kind of exciting. And so that might also be part of that, is that, like, you know, if they're going to bring in someone from games, it's probably going to be like whoever wrote the most popular and you know, most well claimed book on games, you know. And it makes sense to me that I've seen other disciplines, it seems like everybody is like excited to get someone, you know, from games to do something on or talk at their thing. Like, I feel like somebody from games could talk at almost anything because it's just so like loved at this point.
Yeah, I tend to agree. There's, you know, there is a little bit of out of your depthness that happens. I speak from experience. But yeah, I agree. It's I think it's probably to be expected. We glamorize, again, entertainers and entertainment and games, you know, regardless of what you think of ideas like, oh, it's the entertainment of the 21st century or whatever. Enough people believe it to give you the cred.
Yeah. Absolutely. So do you think you would ever write another book, or do you have any other plans like that, like to write? Because I feel like if you wrote another like Theory of Fun 2 or something, like it would be, you know, it would be a massive hit.
So I've got two projects that I've been plonking away at for 10 years, actually. One of which is probably of more interest to you than the other, so I'll talk about the other first. I've been working on trying to gather together essays and, in particular, game postmortems off my website. There's like a million words worth of stuff on my website, and a lot of it gets referenced a lot and, you know, linked a lot. There's essays like Declaring the Rights of Avatars or stuff like The Laws of Online World Design or the postmortems on Star Wars Galaxies that just, they drive all this traffic to my blog every day. They get pointed at, like, the Avatar rights piece is in law textbooks. And so, but it's, I've never collected it. You know, it's been reprinted literally, I think that one may be in as many as 10 books by other people. And I've never put it in a book. And so that's one. I feel like I should kind of gather up a lot of those articles and essays for posterity, kind of thing.
Before you go on to the second one, I have a question about that. Because, like, what strikes me is that, you know, I've been writing about game design for, I don't know, about around 10 years or so. And I feel like, I have a tail of like 4 or 5 years, and I pretty much like either delete or like massively modify most of the stuff that's more than 4 or 5 years old, because I find that like my views change, and, you know, like a lot of my old stuff is like, it's like embarrassing. And I don't know if, do you have that feeling at all? Like, are there any things out there of yours that you're like, oh God, I can't believe I wrote that. That was like wrong and bad. Okay. Yeah. Just making sure.
There's absolutely stuff like that, but there's also stuff that, for whatever reason, some of it has turned out to be of I guess, call it historical importance on a very relative scale, right?
Sure.
Like, there's a lot, like the Rights of Avatars piece in particular has turned out to be super resonant. It was written prior to social networking. And yet the arguments it makes are very, very pointed and relevant today in the realms of social networking.
Right.
You know, what rights do we have when our identities and our context for interaction is managed by third parties, and essentially they are starting to take the form of governments? And, you know, where that was kind of an analogy in the original essay, when we were talking about early virtual worlds and MMOs, it's less of an analogy today. Like, it's getting more real.
Yeah.
And so a lot of the arguments that are in there are turning out to be had all over again. Same thing is true with a lot of the earlier writings on virtual worlds and MMOs. A lot of those are just basically there's a lot of lessons that people need to go back and learn that mm-hmm. are getting kind of forgotten because MMOs have not been on the cutting edge of anybody's attention since about 05, right? Mm.
Yeah.
Since the blush wore off of World of Warcraft, I would say. So it's and Second Life. So I think, there's certainly stuff I'm embarrassed by, but I also think there's plenty there that is of value. And things like the game postmortems, some stuff like that never goes out of style, right?
Right. I mean, sure.
Right? There's stuff like that that's just always valuable. When I did the Star Wars Galaxies postmortems, I did that now, that's got to be a year plus ago, maybe 2 years.
Mm-hmm.
And we're talking about a game that came out in 2003 and ran for 8 years. So it closed years ago. And yet, when I put out those articles, they were picked up by AV Club and Vice and Time. And,
wow.
Right? I mean, yeah. And you know, there was all this attention on them. And it was in part because of the lessons that were in there, even though plenty of people don't remember what the game was actually like, right? Mm-hmm. So, I think a lot of it just depends on the content. So, yeah, I think that book is still worth doing. I wouldn't expect it to be a theory of fun level
right.
thing.
More of an academic sort of resource kind of thing.
Yeah, although, you know, I certainly got a lot of nostalgia player people, you know. I want to read. But, like, a good example would be the complete design for the dynamic ecology in Ultima Online.
Mm-hmm.
Those articles get pointed at all the time still. Like, I see the referrer logs, you know.
Yeah.
Why not put them there?
No,
in there.
For sure. Yeah, I got to read some of those. I was such a UO dominated a lot of my high school years. So I still have like, you know, so the only like the some of the warmest feelings I've ever had for video games are with memories of UO, as I'm sure you've gotten told that before. But
once or twice.
Yeah, yeah,
yeah. It's funny because you know, the thing about UO. The memories that people have in UO and Galaxies, the freedoms are what generated that, and yet at the same time they're also what
destroyed
them in the long run, right?
Sure.
And so that's kind of the challenge, I think, with games like that.
Mm-hmm.
There's no doubt they really touched people. Like, I get that evidence all the time.
Mm-hmm.
And at the same time, it's almost like their inevitable fate is to become, you know, a Shangri-La that you can never get to again.
Right. That's funny. So, okay, so what's the second book that you've been working on?
The second book is called A Grammar of Gameplay.
Oh, somebody asked me. I asked my, I have a little community, and I asked them what I should ask you. And one of the big questions was about the whole game grammar project. And I guess that's what this is?
That's right. And, you know, it overlaps a lot with your work. I think of you as a fellow traveler on this road alongside people like Dan Cook, Stefan Bura, and a few other Joris Dormans and a few others.
Mm-hmm.
It feels to me like, you know, the grammar gameplay thing started because let me think how to give the context. I did Theory of Fun in part because I felt Star Wars Galaxies had succeeded at being a world and failed at being a good game on a bunch of fronts.
Hmm.
Right? Like, the combat game was bad. The, you know, there were just lots of things that were not good game design in it. And lots of it, and this, despite the fact that it turned out there were lots of things that were really good social design. Like, they were good virtual world design. And so Theory of Fun was in part about a boot camp for myself where I was like, wow, I've lost touch with this. Maybe I don't actually know game design at all. And in hindsight, I didn't. Right? In hindsight, I was very much operating instinctively. I was analytical about things, but a lot of it was instinctive. A lot of it was, you know, received wisdom. A lot of it was, wouldn't this be cool-ism?
Right,
you know?
Sure.
All of the things that come about from, you know, kind of practicing a craft through apprenticeship and through, you know, fandom, I guess. And so I did a bunch of things, which included going back and reteaching myself how to program. I had been doing scripting and server-side work on UO and on virtual worlds in general, but I hadn't done front-end client-side rendering and any of that since the 8-bit computer days. So I taught myself how to do that all over again. And started making puzzle games and action arcade games on weekends. Mm-hmm. And while I was researching and thinking about the issues and theory of fun. And so that those two things combined led me to Game Grammar. And also talking with a bunch of people, Dave Rickey, who's pretty much out of the industry now, and Noah Falstein, who just stepped down as chief game designer at Google, but is a friend going back a long time. We'd been talking a lot at you know, conferences and stuff about discoveries in psychology. Evolutionary psychology was undergoing a vogue at the time before it kind of landed in bad odor. And so on. And, you know, saying, wait, so there's got to be, like, cognitive processes we're tapping into here. There's got to be a reason why games are around. Like, why do we do this, right? Mm-hmm. And so we were talking about those things, and the book was one outcome of that. But even in Theory of Fun, you can see the start of Game Grammar. I forget which chapter it's in, but there's a moment in there where I say, so what would a problem like that be like? And I walk through this little checklist. It would have a core problem at its heart. It would offer statistical variation you could move through. There would be a cost to failure, even if it's just opportunity cost. It would give you the feedback so you can learn what you did wrong, right? I mean, there's this little checklist. And at the end, I say, this isn't exhaustive, but if you're not hitting these things, you know, you're probably not hitting for something fun. Mm-hmm. That was the beginning right there. That little list was the beginning of figuring out Game Grammar stuff. And I started, I was CCO at Sony Online at the time. And Rod Humble, who went on to head the Sims franchise and also then worked at Second Life, a bunch of other places. But he's also best known these days for doing art games such mm-hmm. as The Marriage.
Oh, yeah.
Rod was head of the studio there in San Diego for Sony Online. And so we worked together on stuff like EverQuest 2. And I wasn't very involved. I just, like, advised him at a, you know, at a distance kind of thing. I didn't work with the team very much. But we were talking about the crafting system and how crafting in MMOs sucks. It's just press a combine button. And we worked through, that's how we got that checklist, right? We worked through this saying, okay, what is it that makes one of the, like, combat's fun? If combat's fun, why isn't this fun? Mm-hmm. Let's break this down. And we ended up on the whiteboard with a game atom, right? With mm-hmm. like input and a loop and a feedback system and diagrammed it out. And went, oh shit.
yeah.
Right? And part of those discussions is where the marriage came from, actually, because the question was, hey, so could you convey like a theme or a lesson with just the mechanics without a skin?
Right.
And that was part of the experiment there. Jason Rohrer also told me later that the book had also partly inspired Passage.
I was just thinking of that as well.
So that's how the Game Grammar stuff started. I ended up doing a presentation at GDC the next year mm-hmm. where the goal was actually, how do we convey a game system design? Because I think my one-liner was something like, giving people a game design document is like asking them to make a movie from the director's commentary.
Yeah.
Right? It's not like making it from the script. And so is there a way to capture this stuff in a notation?
Yeah.
Right? That's what I was originally after. But you can't do a notation without having the theory. Mm-hmm. And so I started out, and at first I was super bogged down in the notation side, which was is its own problem, right? Then I started finding, oh, look, you know, here's game atoms only restated as ludemes by Ben Cousins, or as choice molecules. I think, is choice molecules the one in Rules of Play?
I don't remember,
but lots of people, right? I mean, several people were all going, hey, so here's this thing. And then Dan did his article, A Chemistry of Game Design. Mm-hmm. And, you know, oh, look, what a surprise, right? Here's similar concept. And he actually had gorgeous diagrams for something that I only had crappy sketches of. Mm-hmm. And after a while, it really felt like we were all touching an elephant that, there's structural stuff implicit in the nature of games that is actually, call it, I don't know if immutable is right. It's just structural. Mm-hmm. It's like it's almost like physical characteristics of what games are like.
Yeah.
And the more you start digging into the theory, the more you end up perceiving that it's complicated. It's both complex and complicated, right? The atom is simple. That one's easy. But when you start getting into richer stuff, particularly when you get into dynamics, right, it gets both complicated and complex. The more you dig into it, the more you find it touches on a lot of fields. You know, like it became apparent to me after a while that the same atom exists whether we're talking about like in a driving game, the controls are it's very haptic and physical, right? Mm-hmm. Whereas in a turn-based strategy game, it's much slower paced typically, and the haptic element is lessened, but the learning loop is still there. Mm-hmm. And you know, there's a good structural case to be made that actually the complete loop is there. It's just we're operating at different speeds, we're operating at kind of different. You know, that your muscles are themselves a game to learn, you know, that kind of thing. Mm-hmm. You know, that means you start finding yourself suddenly in, like I found myself reading blogs on sports medicine and sports training. And then on a different day, I'd find myself reading narrative theory, right? Because the structures and the loops are incredibly similar. It's the nature of the tokens that changes, the nature of the controls, and I put controls in quotes, that changes. But the structures are very similar. But I ended up making this map. I call it a map of game. Mm-hmm. That has all of the different fields that it touches, that my complete picture of what games are like. And I think there's like 30 or 40 in it now. Mm-hmm. And most things about games really focus down in on, you know, four or five at a time. So what I thought was, I'll have this book done for you guys next year. they actually got an ISBN for it, and even it's listed on Amazon as forthcoming, right? Mm-hmm. And then I have now blown the deadline by 13 years and counting.
Wow.
The publisher went away, actually, in the meantime.
So is that like, so 13 years is there a like some kind of like sort of hard walls on finishing it? Like, is it like there's actually like, you know, how much of it is like, oh, it's coming along slowly but surely, and is some of it like, no, there's that, like, I have to, there's something that hasn't been figured out that I need to figure out and is really challenging.
So, I mean, this is going to sound both arrogant and clueless simultaneously. I actually do think I now have kind of a grip on the whole thing. Mm-hmm. The hard part is explaining it. And when you explain it, it gets harder to, you know, you can't hide.
Oh, right? The problem is you got to use English. You got to use words to explain it. And then everything's out the window. Like, you know
right.
what I mean?
And,
Yeah.
I often find that the act of explaining itself helps me figure shit out, right? So
And confuses everyone else in the meantime. Like, yeah. Everyone else is like, wait, but you said this one word, then that now I'm thinking about some other totally different thing, and you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's right. And, you know, one of the biggest ones, and I remember we had some, I think it was actually comments on one of the essays I put on the blog a few years back. You know, the whole question of I'm not even sure how to summarize it. I wrote this article about playing with game and whether game was the right word, right? Because for me, actually, a huge insight that turned out to be super useful was that these structural qualities sometimes just are out there already, right? And some of the obvious examples that I tend to use, there are basically like the necessary requirements for a game exist in the systems of music, the stock market, how Wikipedia works, and my aquarium. It's just that they're missing the bit of intentionality that turns them into what we generally then say, oh yeah, that's a game now.
Sure, right? Like the with the Spoonful of Sugar song, right?
Except that part's actually bullshit. There's lots of systems out there in the world that don't meet the criteria,
mm-hmm.
right? But there is this set of them that do, right? That mm-hmm. because it, to really get it, you know, there's the standard hierarchy that we all use, right? The toy up through puzzle and then into game, and mm-hmm. we all define it slightly differently, but it has a lot to do with solution space, right? And how large it is and where exactly you slice it. Everybody uses slightly different terminology, but we're all broadly in agreement, right?
Yeah.
There's a huge amount of systems out there that are actually puzzles, right?
Sure.
Most of them probably.
Yeah,
but,
I agree.
But there are the ones that are games. And to me, that was one of the big insights, that those are out there. And, you know, it's not like I can suddenly say, oh, music is a game. I've always had this issue with it's hard to fight common usage, right?
Sure. Yeah, well, that's what language is, really, right?
Right. And so for the longest time, it was easy to just go along saying game for this stuff. And then, as you know, there was the great formalism wars of you know, 2015 or whatever. And I started using ludic system to mean systems that meet the criteria.
Mm-hmm.
And then I could say, and if you build one on purpose, then that's an artifact, right? That's a ludic artifact. But the ones that are naturally occurring are still ludic systems. They're
okay.
just out there. And that actually helped clarify my thinking and left the word game alone. And I still use game in casual talk. But, you know, it just helps me be more precise. The other thing that was super valuable out of those discussions in particular was actually it reinforced something that is in theory of fund, and I needed reminded of at a super fundamental level, I guess, which is that if something meets the criteria but the players can't perceive it, then to that player,
it doesn't meet the criteria.
It doesn't meet the criteria.
Ultimately, right? Yeah, everything is like whatever the end user perceives is basically as good as the reality.
Right, exactly. And so that's such an important, I mean, it's a core principle in all fields of design.
Yeah.
But it's also an easy one to lose sight of, I think, especially when we're in formal land, because in formal land, we often have to think in essentialisms and we have to say, oh, but no, this really does meet the criteria. But if the player doesn't see it, as soon as you try to get them to play it, you're hosed. So it's
right.
important.
Well, and the way to think about that, by the way, is just to say that, like, there, you know, just because this meets my formal criteria and players don't get it, there's some other formal reason that they're not getting it, that I may not be aware of that other formal law, but there's some, you know, it can be explained and it can be I'm just sure. trying to push back on the idea that I don't think you would have, but some would have, of like, oh, these are like the limits of, you know, formal theory in general, that, you know, sometimes people just don't like stuff and it's totally mysterious and so therefore theory is not useful.
No, the theory's always useful, right? I think Because I do think we can understand reasons why. Different people's cognition has been trained by their experiences. There are reasons why they might have preferences towards one thing or another. And there's tons of literature out there on that stuff. Like piles. This is not a new problem, right? Vast swaths of academic ink, you know, and, sure. and acres of paper have been spilled on things like learning styles and, you know, cognitive biases and all the rest. So there absolutely are reasons, and we can come to understand them, but I've come to think of it as it's part of the landscape, right? That's part of our territory when we design. We just need to. We can't change those people, right? That's not, well, not in that way. I do think we change people, but you know what I mean.
Yeah.
And then the other thing, though, is that there's a mirror image, too, which is, it also means that if there's something that wants to call itself a game and doesn't meet this criteria, but other people choose to accept it as that and other people don't, you know, basically nobody gets to stand on the high horse and say my take on it is going to be correct, because the audience is always going to end up making a decision.
Sure.
So, that to me was actually a super valuable outcome of those arguments, although they were kind of personally painful, but no need to dwell on that. For me, the upshot of all the game grammar stuff, right, is that I now have, because of hammering on the problem for so long, even though I don't necessarily feel like I can explain it all, like if you push me, I can explain a given piece of it fairly well. I don't have a good organizing principle to explain the whole thing. I've tried using the loop. I've tried doing, I've tried using the map and a few other things, but the biggest thing is that hammering on each of these individual problems and trying to research them with their own fields has led me to internalize a bunch of stuff that now I tend to use kind of intuitively, which is great for me, but right. not so great for passing it on to other people. And so I still wrestle with how to explain it or teach it. But it's been great for me in terms of my own practice. Mm-hmm. I've found that I'll give you a super simple example for the kind of things I've been making lately, right? I've been making an awful lot of abstract strategy board games.
I played a few of them last GDC, and they were really, really cool.
Yeah, I am super proud of them, right? Because kind of for me, one of the other realizations of all this was, you know, I still love making vast, intricate, complex worlds with, you know, designing entire societies. This is like at the complete opposite end of the spectrum, right? It's some abstract tokens on an abstract field. But on the other hand, these are also the kinds of games that last 1,000 years. And I consciously said to myself at one point, you know what? That sounds like a pretty kick-ass design goal. You know?
Yeah.
I would like to try making a game that could last for 1,000 years, or I'll settle for one that feels like it has already been around for 1,000 years.
Sure.
Right? You know, even if it doesn't last, because obviously there's lots of marketing and cultural and reasons why it might not. But
yeah. Those are things that I would just say really quickly, that those kind of, the simpler something is, the harder it is to make it interesting. In a way, like the hardest things to make are these like super simple minimalist kind of things. It's a challenge, I think, if nothing else.
Yeah, you know, even when making the big things, though, like I thought of a UO or a Galaxies as actually being a world with a giant collection of super simple things in it.
Hmm.
And that's actually how, that to me is actually one of the things that, game grammar says that games are fractal. That when you look at a given system in a game, it decomposes into smaller systems. And each of those smaller systems might actually also meet all of the ludic system criteria, right? And that keeps happening until you get to a game that is trivial, which might be the game of picking up the chess piece and setting it down someplace else, right? for a toddler, then this is why that relativism perspective thing matters. To a toddler, that game is also goddamn hard.
Sure.
But most of us have mastered it. It is actually, I mean, you know, objectively speaking, picking up a piece and putting it somewhere is absolutely brutally hard. And if you don't think that, then go try doing it with a claw machine. Look, right, do it with a different interface and you'll realize, holy shit, no, this actually is a brutally difficult problem that's a great basis for a game. It's a, it's the system is for real a game system. It has all of the, you know, emergent challenges, endless statistical variation, you know, feedback loops are present or not in interesting ways. It meets the criteria, right? But most cases are the ones that we have rendered trivial. And of course, our world is full of objects that we have designed to make it trivial. We do not make our tables bumpy. We do not make our tables like water mattresses, right?
Yeah.
So in essence, we've built our world to be the easy mode for that game, right? But that game is a real game. It's just one that we kind of outgrow it. So if you think of game design as fractal, in a lot of ways, that's kind of the trick to being able to build something truly massive, is if you can decompose things that way. In my head, I literally see, like, Star Wars Galaxies. I would tell people, they'd ask, wait, are you sure that we can cut this system and not that one? And I'd be like, yes, because in my head, I see this cool glittering, like, Dyson sphere, and it's got, you know, it's not a solid sphere, it's got holes and patches, and it's got some nodes that are more important than others, but that one only has like two connections to it, and this one's got 12. So if we cut that one, we'll be okay. We want it, but we'll be okay. It's got ripple effect, but we can't cut the one with 12. Right. And they'd be like, but you're saying we're cutting land speeders and leaving in hairdressers in Galaxies. And I'm like, I know, it's ridiculous, but trust me, right? Sure. So that kind of view of it as a lattice, as this fractal web, is kind of just always in my head now. And when I think of something big, I think of it as being made of these smaller parts. And these days, my rule of thumb for smaller things is a lot of rules of no more than three rules, no more than three variables kinds of ideas. When I go into trying to make these strategy games, I literally say, I want, first I'm going to find an interesting, challenging, it's technically it's a topology, like a an interesting play field, okay? The play field is not necessarily a... it's not space, right?
Yeah.
So I'll walk you through the most recent game I just made. It's called Tiny Castles. You have a 2x2 grid, but that isn't actually the topology, right? In the 2x2 grid, it's probably easiest to explain it with playing cards. You've got cards that are 1, 2, 3, and 4, and you have two of each. And you take turns placing the cards in one of the four cells. And you can only place a card in a cell if its value is higher than whatever was already there.
Okay.
Right?
Sure.
So that means the topology of the play field is actually this shifting ground, right? It is not a 2x2. It's got this interesting
third dimension of
third
the
dimension
value, yeah.
That is constantly changing, and it changes every turn, right? Now, the card, your cards are of your color. Let's say I'm playing with the black suits and you're playing with the red suits, right?
Sure.
So then the rule of thumb that I have arrived at that I can kind of quantify in game grammar terms, kind of, is what I call the orthogonal rule, okay? And so... if you have this strategy game, the basic case of it is you keep putting these cards down. Once there's a four, you can take that stack that is topped by a four and replace it with a one if you have it.
Okay.
And then the cards go back to whoever's they are. They go, you get returned to people's piles.
Okay. Right?
But then in this game, the orthogonal rule has to do with the win conditions, right? And this is the shortcut trick that I often use. What we've now got is these four cycling pillars, right? Mm-hmm. That can cycle at different rates, because you can jump from a one to a four.
Okay.
Right? So the permutation space is actually pretty large.
Mm-hmm.
Right? You know what other people have, because there aren't that many tokens. But you have now a large enough space that it can't be held in somebody's head easily.
Right.
Right? And that notion of can't hold something in your head easily, is I formalize that in game grammar. I often use the shortcut of NP hard problems.
Mm-hmm.
But it isn't it's really properly spoken of as capital H hard, capital P problems. Mm-hmm. Because math problems will be NP or P space complete. You know, they fit into certain ranges of complexity. But social problems often are also, quote, hard problems. And we don't have math language to quantify them as much as, you know,
Social science stuff.
Yeah, but a lot of it just isn't quantifiable, barring, right, you know, game theory, John Nash style stuff. A lot of it isn't that.
And even a lot of that is very, like, you know, heavy on assumptions, sort of economic-y.
Yeah,
like,
yeah. If you start putting math into, like, a game of diplomacy,
mm-hmm,
right, you quickly realize, whoa, this is actually a capital H hard problem set of,
right,
psychology. Right. And psychology just operates on other rules, and some of them are non-rational acting. Right. And that's OK. You can read up on them and you can learn them and start leveraging them. And then similarly, physical problems are also often hard. Right. Fine motor control or, you know, endurance or whatever. We can try doing the math of endurance and say, oh, well, if we could model out oxygenation and fast response fibers versus slow response muscle fibers, and, you know, and in theory you could build a math model there, but, you know, we just kind of know that's physically hard, that isn't.
Sure.
Right. And and then there's the cheat one, which is chance. Chance is always hard, right? We're lousy at it. We are terrible at extrapolating probability. So if you start putting some uncertainty in the game, it very quickly balloons into something that we, you know, anything nonlinear, anything stochastic, we cannot hold in our heads. And so there's, you know, there's a set of tools on the workbench, and they're suitable for different purposes. Like chance, chance is basically degenerate math, but it's actually super useful for accessibility, right? It's a great, it's kind of like the ketchup of game design. It's a seasoning that you can put on a system that automatically makes it friendlier to newbies who are not strategic thinkers, right?
Yeah, well, it depends. Right? There's a lot of different kind of manifestations of randomness in games, but that's one of them. Yeah,
your piece on input randomness and output randomness, mm-hmm, I thought was brilliant. Because it really codified and drilled down into that, you know, and randomness is one of those things that, actually, as far as I know, you, Greg Kostikian, and Vegan.
Who was the last person? You broke up a little bit.
Are like the only people who've thought deeply about randomness.
Sorry, say that last name one more time, because it broke up again. Sorry.
The city of Las Vegas.
Las Vegas. Okay, cool. Yeah, I thought you said Vega from Street Fighter or something. All right.
City of Las Vegas, right? Uh-huh. The gambling industry.
Mm-hmm.
But we don't tend to dive into chance. We use it really, we've used it as through folk wisdom, when it turns out there are codifiable, understandable reasons when to use this particular seasoning in a recipe, right?
Right.
So I loved that piece. So this game that I'm talking about actually has no chance.
Mm-hmm.
right? Everybody has the same pieces. Everything is public. Other games can have chance. I think, you know, it's a different way to add a kind of hard problem. And
so, let me throw something at that real quick. So the idea of a system that doesn't have that's totally you know, no hidden information, and so how, and I guess what you are saying is, yeah, but there's some point at which, you know, just the amount of calculation required is so huge that players just kind of like there's a soft look ahead cap, right, based on like just how much a normal human being can or is willing to look ahead. So my argument against that is, yeah, but if a designer chooses that point, then players are not in that sort of uncomfortable position of like, should I calculate out the next thing, like, or not, or should I just do this move? You know what I mean? Like, which to me is a weird choice for players to have to make. It's almost like them having to choose their difficulty setting, or and you know, like, does that make any sense?
It does, but I do think that it's important to bear in mind that the kind of chance matters, right? There are a lot of different kinds of chance distributions, and some of those are, like you said, about look ahead, and some of them are literally the brain is not capable of doing the look ahead. Mm-hmm. So there's a difference between look ahead that is actually possible and look ahead that is not. And that's kind of what I meant by, like, it's a known factor in psych research and, you know, across, it's been validated multiple times. The brain can do linear extrapolation. The human brain is actually pretty good at that. The brain can even do interesting first and second order derivatives on that pretty well. Otherwise, we wouldn't be able to catch a ball, right? Hmm.
Sure.
Where we're extrapolating linearly on several different fronts, right? But what we suck at, and it's like we're missing the floating point chip to do it, okay? Is exponential, nonlinear, and stochastic distributions. We just do not do.
Right.
We look at them and we think they are linear. And we curve fit to that, and we're wrong. And I mean, this can be anything from the ponies to the Black Swan book, where it's treated in the realm of economics, to what we think about the likelihood of a terrorism attack versus dying in a car crash.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, it's a known cognitive bug. Right.
Yeah.
And so there's a difference there between, oh, I'm going to roll D6, which gives me kind of a finite spread, and chance that makes use of curves like that.
Right.
Right. And they each have their place in different ways. Right. If you're going down to even like a strategy game that has a, let's say, a D6 component in it, right? Let's say it's a roll for damage kind of thing, right?
Mm-hmm.
Roll for damage is actually, it's a good example of that fractal thing, right? Roll for damage is a mechanic to summarize what should be a more complex, smaller atom down under there that we're choosing not to model.
Mm-hmm.
Because it starts getting fiddly or whatever, right? And so we're going to put a stand in there and simply say, here's the range of possible outcomes. You need to account for that range. That is a, you know, we can't model everything, right, in any given game. So it's a reasonable thing to say, hey, this is as deep as we're going to go, and we'll just put in, you know, a range or a small curve in there.
Mm-hmm.
Right, it's a cutoff point for how deep you go. That's the use for that kind of randomness, right? It's summarizing an atom that isn't present. Rolling the dice to choose how the weather changes, right, is an example of, okay, we're going to change the environment to a different environment that hopefully has gameplay effects, but we're not going to model the weather,
because mm-hmm.
that's a huge amount of work to do. Right, right, and so there, that's one kind of way to use randomness. stuff like moving along a racetrack is a classic in games for kids because it removes skill and focuses, when used well in game design, what it does is allow the child to work on the cognitive tasks appropriate to them, right? It doesn't, it, you know, and they have cognitive, they have hard games to play.
Sure.
They have the hard game of moving the pieces, of counting the squares. Those are challenging puzzles or challenging problems that are age appropriate. So we use chance for that. You go higher up in your cognitive training and it stops making as much sense. Or you treat it as landscape variation, right?
Yeah.
One of the reasons I believe we play games in part for cognitive training to chunk up heuristics, right? Heuristics they're not solutions. They are decent approximations of solutions that let us get by.
Right.
Right? Rules of thumb.
Yeah, guidelines.
Heuristics need to be, yeah, they need to be responsive to varied situations. So that's why games present statistical variations so that your heuristic can get broader to encompass more types of situations. Sometimes you have a heuristic and you throw a new situation at it and it completely breaks. And that's when we hear players saying they've plateaued because they need to completely revise their cognitive training to account for a variable they did not include, right? And this happens, like, it's famous for happening in among musicians, right? Like, oh shit, I need to throw away everything I know about the guitar fingerboard. I was learning chords. Now I need to understand intervals. Ah, shit. And that's why most guitar players don't get past chords. You have to throw away everything you know,
right?
And build a new heuristic, right? So, chance has its place. And when you have things like stochastic things where that is a stochastic curve is one where we don't put you through a nicely graduated learning ramp. We throw stuff out of the out of band stuff at you. And, you know, in the real world, that happens, right? But in a game, if the intent is to teach the player, then stochastic is often really brutal. It's like throwing the level 100 monster at you on level 1 on a die roll.
Yeah.
That happens.
The other reason I tend to be harsh about that kind of randomness is that it you can actually have a very solvable and kind of like badly designed system that appears unsolved to players because they you know are getting basically like I rolled a one so now it's hard, you know what I mean? Like, whereas actually, like, statistically, if you had played through this a bunch of times, you've had this solved since the second time you've played it, it just seems unsolved because of the huge like variance in the middle of the system.
Yeah. So but that gets back at things like, you know, the proximate range for learning. It gets back at the concepts of flow and all the rest, right? We've always known that there is a channel there, right? That works. And if you're too high above, if you're above it or below it, stuff stops working for the player. There's a good example maybe is like if you played Monopoly and you only had a D3 and other people had a D6, right? There's a whole new problem space there for you to learn that is interesting. Actually, D3 might actually, you'd have lower income but higher odds of picking up monopolies. So that's kind of an interesting one. Mm-hmm. But, right? So saying, oh, through random chance, I got all ones on every roll is in the possibility space, right?
Sure.
It's just a brutal part of the map, of that possibility map. I was talking about the orthogonal rule. We wandered pretty far off. I see these things as tools on the workbench, and they all have different uses, right? There are times where I want to make a game super accessible, or I want it to be a party game or something, and that's what the audience is. Therefore, I go, oh, chance is a good tool here.
Sure, yeah.
Right? There are other times where I go, I want this game to, you know, captivate people and have them take 30 minutes to think of a move. Chance is probably not in there. Instead, I'm looking for really broad permutation space. And that puts me most likely in mathy areas, right? Sometimes I want it to be something that inspires feelings of camaraderie, in which case I'll be looking at cooperative play. I'll be looking at risk profiles. I'll be looking at the roles of altruism and sacrifice, right? And suddenly we're using social tools. So to me, these are tools on the workbench. Mm-hmm. In this little game, you know, we've been stacking these, and the landscape cycles and shifts in ways that the permutation space is somewhat predictable. But the victory conditions are what changes it, because I have one victory condition, which is if you place a card such that what is now showing is 1, 2, 3, 4 of anybody's mm-hmm. in any combination on the board, you win. Or if you place a card such that all the cards on top are your color, you win.
Mm-hmm.
Or if you place a card that prevents the other player from making a move at all.
Okay.
And suddenly, okay, so now we have a game here where we have a total of, it's a 2x2 grid. We have 16 tokens. It's played fairly quickly. And yet it is a, quote, capital H, capital P, hard problem, right? It is actually surprisingly deep. And the idea of the two victory conditions that compete, and that's what I mean by the orthogonal rule. If there is more than one way to earn a victory point, in this case it's victory of the whole game, but in other games, I think you played Settlement, the one with the hexes and the dots.
Yeah, I did.
So in that game, there the standard rule is, hey, I can be flipping other people's in order to gain points, and the value of the dots on the tile is how much they're worth at the end. And I designed the whole game with that in mind, and I finished, and I went, wow, I've ended up with a pretty good B. I've ended up with a B. And then I added the orthogonal rule of, if you make a triangle of three tiles of your color, you can put this bonus, you get a bonus, but the bonus can be destroyed. That one is in competition with the heuristics and the strategies for the other. And so you're constantly forced, I mean, this is almost like a game design hack. Because there are these two ways to do things, and they call for a different mix of resources at all times, and one will probably damage the other at all times.
Yeah.
You always have an interesting choice every turn.
The way I would describe that is like something like strategic axes, like different, you know, the classic one is like Rushdown and Econ or whatever, you know, Rushdown, Econ, Defense or whatever that people talk about in like fighting games or RTS games, where, you know, like, yeah, you can like invest, you know, invest into this late game thing or go for this early game thing now, you know, like just making sure that there are multiple sort of strategic, basically multiple like super strategies, kinds of strategies to pursue.
Well, see, but except this is at the tactical level, not the strategic, right? I think that's the difference probably, is that this is a decision. These are tools. Because you can use either of those two gets you, you know, victory points in a way, right? But they do it in different ways, and they each have different strengths and weaknesses. So your strategy is actually how many of one versus how many of the other do I use,
mm-hmm.
right? And actually there are more. You played the game, so you know that actually territory, like the positioning of how you place the tiles, is also hugely important.
Mm-hmm.
So that one's yet a third one, but it's a good example because the positioning of the tiles is critical if you're trying to play the triangle moves. But it serves a completely different purpose if you're trying to play the capture kinds of moves.
Right.
You can do the captures in any direction. You cannot do the captures in any direction if you're playing for triangles in a given tactical scenario.
Gotcha.
But at the end of the game, the winner has almost certainly not chosen one or the other exclusively.
Oh, right? Yeah. No, no. And that's true with Econ and Rushdown as well. I mean, you know, a lot of the times it's this dance between these multiple strategic axes. And you're sort of like, you know, I go a little bit more in this direction and then you go a little bit more in the sort of counter direction. And then I change and then you adapt. And like this constant dance around a circle of like a rock, paper, scissors sort of circle.
Yeah, so, yeah, to me, it's funny how powerful it has turned out to be to take an abstract game and then simply say at any given move, okay, I've made a game here that has, it meets the criteria. It has this interesting system, and we can play a fun game out of it. And that's fine, but it doesn't feel amazing, right? And that's usually what ends up happening to me, is that it's fine. But it's not amazing. And what I end up needing to find in there is almost a second game. Same pieces, same interactions, almost all of the same atoms, right? But one that has a different structural goal to it. And then players end up having to hold both goals in their head at the same time, each with their permutation spaces, right? Playing both games at once, just it kind of automatically carries me over the line into really interesting strategic territory.
Yeah, I totally agree with that whole like way of thinking about it. And I agree with your feeling about like, you know, that once a game feels that way that I think I get, I agree it goes from being like okay to being really interesting. However, I would just say, and maybe you wouldn't disagree with this, but I would say that multiple goals are not necessarily the only way to achieve that. Like, I think you can achieve that with one goal, but maybe you're just talking about with super simple, abstract, kind of minimal games, in which case maybe multiple game goals are more necessary. But like, well,
I think multiple goals is remember, since the structure is fractal, like in Settlement the multiple goals are happening like on a like on a small arc, right? They happen every few moves, you achieve one of those two goals. Although if the other players are good, they might be successfully blocking you at all times. But so you've got those that are moderate look ahead. But there's still only one way to, there's only one goal in Settlement in the end. You win by having the most points. In the Tiny Castle game, the multiple goals happen to be at the end, right? So they exist on the topmost atom. On the lower level atoms, you don't have multiple goals, except insofar as the, you know, they build towards the final ones. So the multiple goals can happen at any point. I suspect they can happen at any point in that fractal depth thing, right?
So you're talking about also like short-term goals, not like the actual victory conditions, right? Because that's what I was talking about. Right. Like multiple victory conditions aren't necessary to achieve.
They're
this
not necessary.
Thing. Right.
Yeah. Yeah. No. Instead, but again, if games are made out of games, if it's a truly a fractal structure, then me winning at the short-term arc was a game atom too, right?
I think so that's something. I think that's something.
I really do think this is self-similar all the way down.
I think that's probably somewhere that we might disagree a little bit, is that I don't think games are made out of games, because a game is you know, begun and like to me the match structure, like the beginning, middle and end, that's very important and significant. And those little, I agree there are things that like look game-like throughout a game, like there are these, I call those like arcs or sometimes people call them loops, like there are things that are definitely like systemic, and I could see a way way that you could say they're kind of like games in inside a game. But I would say just formally, it is also really good to remember that the overall system, that's the thing we're building, and that is its own thing. And to just say that all these other little things are also games is like saying that every part of a car is a car or something, you know?
I'll advocate for the stronger position. I see going through the entire game, the whole of it, is completing a loop.
Right, but it is also distinct. It is its own thing. Like, there is something special about just that one loop, right?
Sure. It's the container for all of the smaller ones, right?
Right.
But it is still a loop, and...
But is it more than just a container for the smaller ones, though? Because I feel like it is. I feel like it's more than just a container.
What formal characteristics does it have that the other smaller loops don't?
The biggest strategic arc, you know? So, like, you have all these, like, smaller things.
Biggest is a magnitude comparison, not a difference in nature.
The match structure is, I mean, that is the game. And granted, you play that over and over again, and you, so that's what you're saying by it being a part of a larger set of loops. But the rules and the system that we're building, that's the complete system, is the game, is the match.
Let me put it this way. I guess maybe this is a way to split the hairs on this. You know, there are, for example, tournament structures of repeated iterations of games that include shit like brackets, let's say, where people actually play games with the bracketing, right? You're familiar with that stuff, right? We can say, for example, absolutely, people can play games with the bracketing, but the real thing is the actual match, mm-hmm. right? Sure. And then we can drill down into the actual match of something like soccer is one where they play with the bracketing a lot in the World Cup stuff. Oh, we need to eke out enough points. So if we play for goals as opposed to playing just for victory, right? It's a great example of those. Oh, look, one of those orthogonal goals popped up, right? We can get enough points to tie, which gets us through the bracket, you know, whatever.
Oh, I see.
Right, so that there's alternate goals start appearing at that tournament level, but then you play the match, okay? But then within the match, like, soccer has at least two distinct games in it. It's got the standard game of soccer, and it has the penalty shootout, which is unquestionably a different game, right? It's clearly not the same. It's built out of a couple of atoms that are very similar, but it's clearly not the same. It has different durations, different structure. We say the game of soccer is those two things complete.
Sure.
But we could totally take penalty shootouts, just like we can take basketball shootouts and use that to make horse, right? And then even within those, like, each penalty kick is a loop, right? That has a very clear defined middle and beginning, middle and end, and victory conditions and strategies and all of it. So when I say they're self-similar, it isn't about the debate over whether or not one has primacy. You know, is the tournament more important? You know, is the World Cup more important than a match? That isn't really what I'm interested in. What's useful to me as a practitioner is that I can use all of the same analytical tools. I can use all of the same evaluation tools on a match of soccer, on a penalty shootout, on one penalty kick. I can also use them on the bracketing and on the entirety of the World Cup. That, to me, is the value of saying that they're self-similar. So when I say, oh, it's all a game, or games are made out of games, what I really mean is what we have here is nested ludic systems, each of which, if in isolation, right, meets all of the criteria of, you know, the formal definition of a game. And one piece of evidence I'd offer for that is managing soccer teams is clearly a game. Football Manager is a thing, right? What does it do? Below a certain point, it uses chance to not model everything, right? But there is that game of playing the tournaments and the brackets where you as a coach get to play that. and there are video game versions of it that attempt to simulate out the matches to a certain point. So there's something that is a functioning ludic structure. At the match level, we have a functioning ludic structure. At the shootout level, we have a functioning ludic structure. At the penalty level, we have a functioning ludic structure. And I'd go further. At the moment of trying to kick the ball, we have a functioning ludic structure. Anybody who's ever played the game of I'm going to try kicking a ball and hit the same point 12 times, right, knows that's a really hard game, right? And it fits all the criteria. So that's what I mean by the nesting. The value isn't about whether or not one of those is more special. The value is that I can use that and say, okay, each of these loops that are of different size and magnitude and, yes, relative importance, each of these loops can be designed. Each of these loops should have strategic depth. Each of these loops should have statistical variation to get me broadening my heuristics. Each of these should be a worthy game. That to me is the good, is the design value as a practitioner.
Okay. Yeah. So we're kind of over on time. So I just wanted to say, really quickly, can I get your impression of what the state of game design writing theory is? Do you think that things, because you were just talking about that whole era with when you started the game grammar and Dan Cook's blog was big, and it seemed like 5 to 10 years ago there was just like this kind of renaissance of game design writing, and in the last few years, like 3 or 4 years, a lot of my favorite game design writer type people have stopped, and there haven't been like a big crop of new ones really necessarily. So that's my perspective, and I'd love to hear yours.
Yeah, I think there's probably a few factors there. First is that was very much a practitioner eruption, right? And a lot of the writers today, just as before them, are academic. So that's one difference, right? Another is that the younger generation of folks who are figuring stuff out, a lot of this stuff is kind of obscure. People aren't aware of it. People don't know it's out there. You know, there is no book on this stuff other than fairly academic and difficult to read ones, right? Uh-huh. So I think here there is Joris Dorman's and Ernest Adams' book on machinations, and that is absolutely a compatible with game grammar working out of one direction, right? In this. A different one I often use as an example. Out of those, there's also Characteristics of Games, uh-huh, which is the Garfield, Gutierrez, Elias one, which is very good, I think, but it's kind of from, you know, it's a bit more on the patterns side than on the, you know, notation analysis side. But again, touching the elephant, right? So some of these are out there, but I also count something like Steve Swink's book on game feel. He's touching the elephant from the haptics side, but it's a very rigorous working out of the haptics, right? So, but all of those are written by working designers who have other things to be doing.
Sure.
Right? The academics are starting to dig into this more. I was at this fantastic conference in Banff, Canada, and it was called Computational Modeling of Games. And it was a bunch of the people who work in the procedural generation area, and Joris was there, as well as several other academics who've taken up kind of the game you know, they think of it as, we are going to model and simulate games as a mathematical entity, right? And so there are folks who are working at it from that side, but they're academic.
Right.
And, you know, the most practitioners don't follow the academic scene. So, you know, and then finally, we're entering a period where, you know, we are in a period of larger budgets and so on. So a lot of the indies did do work down these lines, thinking here of the book that Anna Anthropy and Naomi Clark did together.
Mm, yeah.
That one also, right, for all of the facts that, you know, we may have been on the opposite side of Anna in formalism wars or whatever, mm-hmm, nonetheless, she's got strong formalist streak too, right?
Sure. I mean, yeah.
Looking at the book, there's some stuff in there that's like, yeah, that lines up, that more touching the elephant, right?
Yeah.
So it happens, but I think it's important to realize it was never a very large group of people.
Right.
And you know, I mean, it was small enough. It used to be that many of us, we would just get together at GDC every year.
Right.
And it, me and Dan, and we would have some of the academics, like Michael Mateus, for example, would be there, and Jesse Schell would be there. And but so would Ian Bogost, who is also touching the elephant, but from a very different, you know, he's also exploring formal characteristics of interaction. Mm-hmm. Just he comes at it from philosophy. And, right?
Sure.
But his stuff still fits. Like, to me, this all integrates because it's all the same elephant. So it's out there. It's just, it was never that easy to find.
I get you, yeah.
You just have to keep digging for it. And right now, a lot of it is pretty academic and difficult to follow.
Right.
But it's happening. There was a great article by Catherine Neal not very long ago. If you Google Catherine Neal, that's with a K-A-T-H-A-R-I-N-E, I think, and Neal, N-E-I-L, design tools, you should find, first she did an essay that was published, it was on Gamma Sutra and on Medium both, that gives, it's actually neat, it gives a history and credit to all of us from 10-15 years ago. It says, look at all this, Doug Church was offering formal abstract tools, and Staffan Björk wrote a book on patterns, and wow, what happened to that stuff, right?
Yeah,
it's the history, and then makes the case it's time to revisit this stuff, it's time to go back to it. And at GDC, she gave a little talk where she walked through some of the tools that are now available, ranging from Machinations to Artisy Draft to others. You know, Artisy is a very formalist approach to planning game narratives and stories. But you know where I think, in a weird way, the influence ended up poking out?
Where's that?
Unity. Unity and Scratch and Game Maker and all of these other things, since when they set out to try to make game making IDEs. And this is the same thing I ran into when I developed Metaplace. You have to go back to a formalism about how our game's structured. And sure, there's programming formalisms too, like whether you go OO or not or whatever. Mm-hmm. But fact of the matter is, you quickly end up at concepts of tokens or objects, verbs, currencies. I think there's a reason why all of these tools end up as objects with messaging events and currencies and topology spaces. And it's because games are made out of those things. And they are touching the elephant too. And so I actually think that these integrated game IDEs like Unity are giving formalism lessons to all the game developers in a way that was not true 10 years ago. If you even go back and look at the formalisms in Unreal versus the formalisms in Unity, they are very different. And I think part of that is because Unity kind of started at a place closer to seeing the elephant.
And just that it's easier for people to just literally dive in and start building systems.
Not just that. It's that the tools themselves are structured in a way that is compatible with the kinds of systems that games are.
Right.
Right. You know, I often do napkin sketches of game flows where I break down the verbs, the currencies, and the objects. Right. Mm-hmm. You can napkin sketch and analyze something. That's where I ended up with that whole notation line of game grammar, was on that. And when you look at the implicit structures that are in a game maker or a Unity, that's also kind of how they work. And yeah. So, yeah, it's almost like they're training people in certain kinds of game formalisms.
Yeah, it makes sense. I agree with that, and it may be that we're sort of in a learning mode right now, and so that we might, you know, sort of be like planting the seeds for the next generation of writers and people actually coming out and like trying to elucidate theory and that kind of stuff. So because that's what I'm specifically, I agree with you that like the learning is probably going faster than it ever has, but the discussion discussion, which is maybe the other half of it.
The documenting.
Yeah, exactly. That's what seems to me to be a little bit lower than it has been. But perhaps it just wanes, you know, goes up and down over time.
Well, maybe I'll write my book. Maybe Tighe will finish his. Maybe we can get Dan to stop designing five games at once and for Spy Fox and actually write more down.
That'd be great.
Maybe you'll do it.
Sure. Yeah. No, I'll keep writing articles, but there's a few other people, but I've been trying to actually get. I've been trying to encourage more people to write. I think one of the things is I started this little website that's going to just like kind of be curated content and sort of like whenever someone writes a new game design article, hopefully they can like send it to us and we can write and talk about it. And, you know, maybe we can do things like, oh, the best game design articles of 2017, like, you know, that kind of thing that kind of gives a little bit more kind of institutional, you know, the feeling that someone will read this if I write a game design article. I feel like that's some important. We kind of had that a little bit with Game of Sutra and a few other websites, not as much anymore. And so I feel like that's something that maybe it's those kinds of things that will also help.
Yeah, it's I've been watching the site develop. So, we'll see. Right. So much of it is just about the community these days is so spread out. That is definitely a factor. I think that moment of blogs that were very interconnected and everybody reading them all every day, discussions happening across the blogs was, it also one of the factors, right? Mm-hmm. The more diffuse the community is, the harder it is to capture that feeling of like a salon.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah, that's true. All right, so we should wrap it up. Thank you so much, Raf Koster, amazing game designer, writer, and great dude. And thank you so much for coming on.
It was my pleasure. This was a lot of fun.
All right, well, thanks again.
This podcast is made possible by the patrons at patreon.com. To support the show, visit patreon.com/KeithBurgun.